you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Welcome to The Fandom Files. We're a Sci-Fi Wire podcast about people who really, really love stuff. I'm Jordan Sackard. I'm the features editor here at Sci-Fi Wire. Flying solo on this one, but Emily Gaudet, my normal co-host, will be back next week with some good news. So that's exciting. We are going to jump right into it because we've got a really cool interview for you today. Daniel Myrick is the co-director of the iconic game-changing, and you know, people say that a lot, game-changing. This actually changed cinema in a lot of ways, financially, stylistically, especially for horror movies. The Blair Witch Project, which is now 20 years old. I am so old. I saw this movie when I was 13 years old in the movie theater. My friend Corey told me there was this movie about like kids who got killed or something, and we thought it might be real. So of course we wanted to go see some people get murdered on screen. And we slipped into the theater and we went and saw it. And now I'm talking to the director 20 years later. And now here's our guest this week, Dan Myrick. He is celebrating this year the 20th anniversary of truly an iconic horror movie that he made, started a whole subgenre, I would say. Direct co-director of The Blair Witch Project. It will be screening this coming week at the Austin Film Festival, and that's why we're talking to him and really excited to be chatting with him. Dan, thanks for being on the show.
Glad to be here.
So, yeah, 20 years since Blair Witch Project. You know, you guys celebrated it this summer. Is it feel insane? Like, how is it, have you been celebrating, and is that wild to you?
Well, it's kind of hard to believe it's been 20 years. You know, it just all goes by so fast. But yeah, it's been a lot of fun. It's nice to see a whole new kind of group of fans embracing the movie and excited about it. And our, you know, the original fans have been very devoted. So yeah, when you look back and see how big the movie became in those days, it's still a little hard for me to believe. But it was a wild ride, and it's fun to see it all, sort of a new generation of people embracing it.
You know, it's wild to me that, and I just read this recently, you guys had come up, you and Eduardo Sanchez, your co-director, came up with the idea in like 1991. So this was, you know, 8 years in the making still. This is like, no one had thought of this in the time in between you thought of it and you actually made the movie. It was still a unique idea.
Yeah, it was in film school. We were both, UCF graduates, and, you know, we were like a lot of film students do, you know, sitting around, you know, batting around ideas. And this particular one started off with sort of this kind of creepy house in the woods and what it would be like if it was like a documentary going into it. And from there, it sort of germinated, and we kept, you know, batting around and spitballing ideas about it and formed a story and then a premise. And over, you know, the next few years, it sort of developed into what it ultimately became. But yeah, those kinds of things typically, you know, gestate for a while and take time, and they organically grow. And Blair was no different.
You know, it's funny. I was 13 when the movie came out, so I saw it with my buddy. And you know, I had, you know, there was no Twitter. There was, you know, internet was still pretty young. He told me, you know, he had heard of this movie that, you know, seemed like it was real footage. So we see this movie, we go to the movies. I don't know like how I got in, but we got in at 13 and we're like watching it and being like, is this real? Like, I was truly, you know, I was enjoying it. I thought it was like really well done, and also was kind of scared because I may have just watched people get murdered. So the fact that the secret was kept so well. I mean, it feels A, impossible today, but B, like, yeah, it's just unbelievable that you were able to keep that secret.
Yeah, it's certainly, I don't think you could do it the same way today because everyone's a bit more savvy online, and the word gets out a lot quicker than it did back in those days. And, you know, it was sort of kind of film that was so far out of the norm. It was disarming when people went into the theater and saw this, like, effectively it was a home video. You're just not used to seeing that kind of aesthetic on the big screen. So it sort of caught a lot of people off guard. And that certainly was part of, I think, the mystique behind the movie and why a lot of people really enjoyed it. I can't, you know, tell you how many times someone said just what you just said, where they went in thinking it was real. until the credits rolled at the end. And that was part of the fun, is not only when they got exposed to the reality of it being a movie, they wanted to bring their friends in to kind of trick them as well. So it ended up being like an inside joke that everyone was playing on their friends.
Yeah, I think my buddy who I saw with my friend Corey, he had an older sister, and I think she told him about it. And so maybe she was pranking us and I didn't even realize it.
Yeah, maybe.
You know, here's the thing, like, you were planning on tricking people from the start. When it's at Sundance, you guys put out posters, you said, you know, missing people, like, you went into this, it wasn't just a marketing thing, way before you ever thought you'd sell this thing, that was the goal, I feel like.
Well, actually, even before that, Greg Hale, the producer, and I produced a little 8-minute proof of concept video in Orlando. Basically, its intention was to sort of, like, you know, get a room full of doctors or dentists to give us money for the movie. So we did a little kind of mini version of the conceit of it was, you know, a found footage film, and that we were going to get our hands on this footage, and local authorities were doing a search for the kids. So we produced this little 8-minute, what we call the investor reel. And that ultimately aired on John Pearson's split screen show on Bravo in his first season. So we were sort of going in with that sort of fact or fiction conceit way early on.
Right.
And by the time we got to Sundance, it was firmly established. But we just thought that was a scarier way to present a horror movie. And unfortunately it worked out.
When you go to Sundance, like, did you have expectations you were going to sell this movie for $1 million bucks and it was going to, you know, you guys made websites, you guys really went all in? Did that idea come later, or did you have this, like, formed plan?
You know, obviously, when you make a movie, you hope you get into Sundance or one of the big festivals, and you hope that ultimately you'll sell it. You know, you want to make your money back, and investors get their money back and whatnot. So that is definitely a goal. You know, outside of that sort of, you know, big picture notion, our strategy was helped along a lot by the people that came on board, like Klein and Walker, Jeremy Walker, who was our publicist. He came on board when we screamed in New York, so he had a lot of advice for us going into Sundance. Kevin Fox, which is one of our producers, he was an experienced LA producer, so he connected us with a lot of people in LA. So we had a lot of hand-holding going into Sundance, how to position the movie, how to set it up, and we got a lot of good advice in that regard. So we weren't just going it alone. You know, as far as the website and sort of the initial promotion, that was all us, but those guys embraced the movie, really loved the film, and got and kind of steered and guided us through that process once we got into Sundance.
And I know there was early adopters, early fans, right? You guys had a newsletter. Like, there were people that were, you know, this podcast is all about, you know, obsessive fans. So there were people who were kind of on board from the beginning, even before, you know, the buzz started building.
When we finished airing that 8-minute investor reel on split screen, John Pearson's website sort of blew up. He had a forum, and it was going crazy. And John called me and said, "Hey, you guys need to put your own website up because I need to steer all these eyeballs over to you guys." So Ed had experience like building like web pages and stuff at his job in Maryland. So we built a real cheap website. We were able to steer people to that and have our own kind of setup and forum where people could discuss it and whatnot. And from that, a core group of fans that really embraced the movie, loved the mythology, they were in on it with us. They created their own websites and it really grew kind of organically out of their enthusiasm. So, and they were, you know, with us from the very beginning and are, you know, still hanging to this day. So it's pretty neat to see that, that core group, you know, having been with us from the beginning, it's really rewarding, I think, as a filmmaker.
Did those people know the deal? Did they know that this was actual footage documentary, but it was a fictionalized film?
Yeah, as far as I know, they knew. I mean, the thing is, on our website, if you drill down a little bit, you could see that we were making a movie. You could sign up to the mailing list, and we would update people with behind the scenes stuff. I wrote a little filmmakers, basically it was before blogs came out, but, you know, I was doing updates while we were on set. So if you wanted to know the behind the scenes and how we were making it, all you had to do was sign up to the mailing list. So those guys were in on it. But if you didn't bother to do that, you could have fooled yourself into thinking it was real by just perusing the website casually. So it just depended on how much you wanted to drill down.
Well, I just think it's really cool that you how we're doing this kind of multi-platform thing. Now we're in this era where, you know, people have, they continue things through podcasts, they continue things through comic books and books. And you guys were doing that. You had a comic book, you had, you know, you had the website, you had a doc that actually aired on Sci-Fi, right? It was spelled differently, but it was Sci-Fi.
Yeah, that was, you know, one of our favorite parts of the whole rollout was, you know, we had the movie, because originally we weren't sure how the film was going to be formatted, whether it's going to be like a standard documentary with the found footage kind of inserted in. Mm-hmm. So originally we shot a bunch of supporting footage, like interviews with the parents and, you know, brother and, you know, experts in the field and, you know, Blair Witch researchers and whatnot, locals. And so we shot a bunch of content. So we had that already, you know, kind of on hand, and then Sci-Fi, then we decided to just go with the found footage for the actual movie release. But Sci-Fi stepped in and said, hey, we'll pay for you guys to do a Blair Witch special for us. So we were able to shoot a lot more cool behind the scenes or, you know, supporting content. And that kind of allowed us to kind of really allow the audience to see the backstory behind the Blair Witch and everything that happened out in the woods, if they wanted to, that you could dive into all that backstory and then go see the movie itself or not. Either way, it worked fine. But it was a nice luxury to be able to do that. And then ultimately when the film was released on VHS and DVD, they accompanied it with that behind the scenes, that supporting material. So that was a nice kind of bonus for the fans.
What did you think about, were you involved at all with, you talked about you did the film, but, you know, there's young adult books, you know, the Blair Witch Files. Did you guys help develop those or did someone buy the rights? Like, it became a huge thing.
We had sort of a cursory sort of overview of what was going on. And, you know, Ben Rock was instrumental in kind of putting together sort of the Blair Witch Bible to make sure everything stuck to the chronology. The books and the comic books didn't stray too far out of the core canon that we had created. But as far as the, you know, the nuts and bolts of it all, you know, artisans sort of just took it and ran with it. And, you know, before I knew it, there was like comic books and keychains with Blair's logos. And I mean, it just got crazy. I mean, there are video games and, you know, we were as stunned as anybody about how big and how multi kind of layered merchandising that the movie sort of spawned. And so there's no way to keep track of it all.
I mean, that's nuts. This was like your big breakout thing. And all of a sudden they're doing the giant multi-platform stuff even before the movie even comes out.
I know. It was crazy. I mean, I remember sitting in the offices of Artisan and John Hegeman, who was head of the marketing department there, got a call from Warner Brothers on, wanted to know when we were going to release our movie because they were trying to, you know, figure out how they wanted to release Stanley Kubrick's film, Eyes Wide Shut. We're like, what the hell is going on? it's like our little goofy $30,000 movie is like, you know, they have the studio sort of concerned about their release pattern. Are you kidding me? So that's when it sort of kind of became surreal for us, and you know, we definitely knew we weren't in Kansas anymore by that time.
I mean, this movie made like $250 million worldwide, and so clearly people were steering it in the right direction. Were you nervous that like this was getting all out of your hands, or you know, this is much bigger than you ever? I mean, I'd be overwhelmed. I'd be like going insane.
Well, I mean, part of it is like you're obviously, you know, euphoric and ecstatic that the movie's doing so well, which is, you know, every filmmaker's dream. But at the same time, you know, it's no longer your film. I mean, and the critics being who they are, they're human beings like anybody else, you know, when initially they really embraced the film and they were raving about it. And this was before the days of Rotten Tomatoes and stuff, but it was getting thumbs up all across the board. And then, you know, after it came out and the hype continued growing and, you know, just getting insane, then it became fashionable to sort of bash the movie. So that whole trend started and we're like, what happened? And so we had a trial by fire, because something that gets that big, you sort of go through that, you know, that cycle. And, and by the time, I think towards the end of its release, we were sort of ready for Blair to take a breath and let it die down and not continue, beating it. But, But yeah, but that's, you know, that's a good problem to have, I always say.
I mean, what was it? The studio.
My movie's too big. You know, it's like, that's a good problem to have. Trust me.
But you know, then, you know, like Artisan wanted to make it. So they made a sequel even when you guys weren't ready for it. And so how did you feel about that?
Well, that's it. I mean, that was one of those things that once you sign on the dotted line and you sell your movie, you basically, the rights then go to the buyer. And it's like selling a house, right? So, you know, they consulted with us about, you know, making a sequel. And our advice to them was to wait, to give it a couple of years, let all the hype die down, as I described. And they didn't want to wait. And they wanted to go right into another one and strike while the iron was hot. And we thought that was sort of ill-advised. But they did so anyway. And that was sort of, a wake-up call for us. Like, oh, okay, well, that's the way Hollywood works, and now we know. And the thing is that, you know, Joe Berlinger, who was the director on that, is a really good director.
Yeah,
I like him a lot.
Yeah.
And he's a super smart guy, and I think he sort of got caught up in the vortex of that decision as well from the studio. He wanted to kind of, you know, do a narrative studio movie, and this was felt like a good fit. You know, he's a documentary filmmaker, Blair's sort of docudrama kind of thing, so... it sounded good on paper, but I think the fundamental flaw with the film for me was that it sort of broke our mythology. Had you not had the first movie, the second film as a standalone film is not a bad movie on its own merits. It was just, it's tough to make that sequel work.
I mean, you know, the thing about this, the first movie, was that the reason I think the found footage element works so much is a lot of the time they're just arguing about whether they should be filming or not. And, you know, where's the map? It's creepy peripherally for a lot of the time, but it's a lot of, like, you know, 20 something squabbling, and which makes it feel very, very real.
Yeah, no, that was one of the central questions for us, is like, we needed a reason to have the camera continue rolling. So we needed to establish that, you know, Heather was very determined and insecure and wanted to prove herself so she'd keep rolling. And then ultimately what started out as a film project for her school ended up being kind of a chronicling of their survival. So, you know, we had a reason for that camera to continue rolling, even when those guys are saying to shut it down.
You know, some of those townspeople too, like Mary Brown, the religious woman. I know some people were actual townspeople, some people were actors. What about her? Is it possible to cast someone that authentic? Or she was incredible.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's it. You just have to go into town and find those people. And you know, with regards to Patty DeCoux, who played our Mary Brown, an actress and a dancer when she was young. She passed away, I think, a few years ago. But she was totally embraced the character, totally embraced the backstory that we wrote for her and played it, you know, flawlessly. So it's just finding those people that, I mean, part of what you want in a documentary style thing like this is you don't want anyone to feel like an actor. You want them to look in real and feel real. So you have to strike that balance between someone who's willing to portray a character, but just be themselves, because that's why you're casting them. You love their look and love the way their physicality and their voice. And so you don't want them to embellish or start acting when the camera's rolling.
You know, I have a normal co-host on this show, Emily, who's not here today, but one of the scenes we talk about a lot when we talk about this movie is at the beginning when the mother, I think it's in front of a supermarket, she's talking about the legend and the baby keeps covering her mouth. That to me was very foreboding when you think about what the movie is, but that I don't know if like that couldn't have been in the script. Was that in the script?
No, that was total ad lib. Yeah, that was, we just lucked out with that shot. She just came out of the store, and the guys were interviewing her, and the baby right on cue. I think her name's Gretchen, but yeah, she's in her 20s now,
yeah,
which is weird.
Right?
But it is it's one of those little magical moments that you can't really anticipate or script, and we just captured it while the camera was rolling, and it ended up being, you know, one of the, you know, great moments in the film.
So when you look back, you know, this movie had a huge impact, not only at that moment, but then obviously like for years and years to come, we're still feeling it with Paranormal Activity and so many other found footage movies. What do you make of that when you're watching these movies? Is that a sense of pride, or like, hey, get your own idea?
Oh, no, I'm totally flattered. You know, my only gripe with anyone that attempts this sort of style or conceit. It's just to do it well, and you know, don't half-ass it. You know, some people will go in there and they'll think they can just throw a camera around and hand it to an actor, and they'll get something that is Blair Witch-like, and that's not how we did Blair. So a lot of work, a lot of thought, a lot of energy went into making it look like none did. So, but when it's done well, you know, like Paranormal Activity, and there's, you know, a few examples of where the filmmakers get it and execute well. They do, the films are very effective, and, you know, history has proven that out time and time again. So, you know, whether it's a found footage movie or a Western, just do execute it well.
Which have been some of your favorites?
I love Paranormal Activity. I always joke to my friends, like every film student I know tried to shoot a movie in their apartment and failed miserably. And this is a movie that takes place in a guy's apartment, and you're riveted the whole way through. And like that in itself is quite an accomplishment. So,
right.
So that was a fun movie. Cloverfield I thought was a lot of fun. And then you see there are moments in movies where they employ this sort of technique, and whether Blair inspired them or not, but it this sort of, you know, documentary aesthetic is, you know, works on a different part of the brain, I think, especially for horror. And when it's done well, it can be very, very effective, and it's cool to see it attempted.
Did you see Searching last summer? Or maybe a couple summers ago, I don't even know, but a couple years ago.
Yeah, someone mentioned that to me. I have not seen that.
Yeah, it's really good because a lot of it happens online too, you know, so it's like the next generation, I feel like, of a Blair Witch type thing, found footage.
I'll be sure to check it out.
Yeah, you should. I know you got a new thing. You had, you know, you signed a deal with iHorror last year, so you've got a bunch of stuff going on now. But things must have been coming at you fast and furious after this movie was released, and then you seem to have taken some time off. So what was that period like for you?
It was great. I mean, you know, we did a lot of stuff right after Blair and sort of got completely enmeshed. I did like 6 movies for Warner Brothers, and I did another film in Morocco called The Objective. And honestly, it was a time where I was just had my first kid, Tucker, and I wanted to sort of like regroup and spend some time with the family and not be an absentee dad, you know, through my kids' formative years. So I just, you know, took a little bit of a sabbatical and hiatus and just focused on being a husband and a dad for a while. And I did a lot of writing and a lot of projects I put on, you know, on hold. But now my son's 14 and he just saw Blair Witch for the first time last night, actually.
Oh, wow, really?
Here in Boise. So that was cool. I just think life, work, you have to have a balance. And so now we opened up the studio in Florida, of all places, and I just finished my last movie called Skyman, which is premiering at Austin Film Festival at the end of the month. And we're also doing a test screening here today, actually, in Boise at the Horror Film Festival. So, yeah, I'm back in the mix and doing some cool projects. And now that my kids are old enough to sort of, you know, appreciate what it is Dad does. My wife has been very, very supportive. She's a writer in her own life, mm-hmm. in her own right. So it's good to have her support and keeps me in check as well. So, you know, I like to do the kinds of projects I like to do sort of on my own terms. And LA can really be, you know, tough on independent filmmakers. So you just have to kind of, again, strike a balance between, you know, doing what it is you love and want to do. But you also, obviously, it's a business and you got to make money at it. So you just have to find a way to make it work without selling your soul.
Tim Rahal, God, I know. I mean, like, not to be presumptuous, but I'm sure, like, this movie's made for $60,000. You probably have, you know, some very small investors. It makes a lot of money worldwide. You were probably in a pretty good position for a while after it happened to kind of take your time.
No, yeah, no. We joke about it that we could finally live a sort of a middle-class lifestyle that all of our friends were living. You know, they went on and, you know, got real jobs. So it was nice to be able to buy a house and, you know, and, you know, live a relatively comfortable life and make movies. I mean, that's, you know, that's one of your goals as a young filmmaker, is to be able to pay the light bill.
Yeah. I mean, as a writer, I totally get that. You know, the 2016, they revived it, you know, they came out with that movie. Like, what do you anticipate? Is there a future going forward?
You know, it's a good question. I know Ed and I have always kind of fantasized about the idea of shooting sort of an origin story about Ellie Kedward and certainly in the whole kind of universe, Blair canon, there's a lot of stories, like, you know, everything from Rustin Parr to Eileen Treacle, that could be mined into their own standalone films. So we love that idea of sort of going back to the roots of the chronology and the universe we've created and making films based on those stories. So, you know, Lionsgate hasn't embraced that notion yet. We hope one day they will, but, you know, we'll be around. If they want the original creators to come back and make a movie, then we'll be happy to oblige.
What did you think of the second, the one of 2016?
I liked it. I mean, I thought those guys were real fans of the movie, of the original, which was good. They stuck to the mythology, which is a refreshing thing for me. I think my only downside was that it felt like it was sort of dipping into the same well that we did originally, but you know, it was executed well in that regard. But again, it's like someone else, you know, raising your kid. You know, it's like it's hard to be completely objective about how good they are at that job as you. But I thought, all things considered, I thought they did a good job.
Last question: what did your son think of the movie last night?
He said he loved it. No, that is his job. He's supposed to tell us that. No, he really enjoyed it. And now at least he has a reference as to what all the hoopla is about.
But, right.
He told me he really liked it. So that's good. I got his seal of approval.
We saw it at a good age, about the same age that I did. So
he's got to kind of say yes.
Well, listen, so I know it's you're doing a screening and a Q&A at the Austin Film Festival on Saturday, right?
Yeah.
Well, listen, Daniel, thanks so much for taking the time. It was really a lot of fun, and congrats on the ongoing legacy of this movie.
I appreciate it, man. Thanks a lot, and have a good day.
You too. Didn't I tell you that was an excellent interview? I mean, more because of him than me. I asked him some questions, I'll say it. But yeah, Daniel Myrick and the Blair Witch Project 20th anniversary. Goddamn, 20 years. The screening is at the Austin Film Festival this coming Saturday. If you're in Texas, you should go check it out. Or if not, you know, go watch The Blair Witch Project. It's available on like all on-demand services. I got it streaming on Stars. I didn't realize I had Stars, but apparently it comes with my cable package. So I watched it again last night. You should go watch it and then listen again to this interview. And as always, give us 5 stars and a good review on iTunes. I cannot stress that enough. I will walk into the woods myself if we don't get enough good 5-star reviews. Next week. Bye.